You saw this, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. You sent me several times. Those are the sort of chairman pleasing things, you know.
Now that you've got it where you want it, I'll move it.
Yeah.
I apologize for your inconvenience tonight. Somewhere along the way, there was a failure to communicate, and I think it was probably me. And the auditorium was double scheduled. Robert Houston said he's been on campus for 17 years. It's the first time he's ever been on this part of the campus, so I think it was good to get him over here anyway. I hope you'll stay afterwards and have some punch and cookies and talk to David Kirby. I'd like to announce some upcoming meetings. Yes. A little more. What? Why not move down a little closer? Next Wednesday night. No, that's what happens when we turned up.
I'll yell.
I'm going on.
I'll yell louder.
Next Wednesday night, we have our first student reading of the semester in the Modern Languages Auditorium. And tomorrow night, in the Modern Languages Auditorium, the poet and scholar Houston Baker will be reading from his poetry. He's the director of the Black Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. He'll also will be lecturing Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock in the Modern Languages building. And upcoming is a two-day festival of Poets of the Southwest. That's November 1 and 2. And I've put a lot of flyers about this out on the table.
Maybe to convince myself that I'm still alive, because they do sound a little bit like obituaries, don't they? But that's not the only mixed-up feeling I'm having this evening. I would say that I'm at a loss for words, but that will not be the case, as you will see. I've been in Arizona for a week now, thanks to Alan Woodman at NAU and Carla Elling at ASU and Lois Shelton here, and thanks to the father of us all, the National Endowment for the Arts, that's making this trip possible. And tonight's my last night. This is my last reading. It's many things are luring me home. Not the prospect of a biweekly paycheck is one. I'd stay forever if I could to get them to send it out here, but I better go back. But what could be better than meeting people like Steve and Bob Houston and Jane and John Anderson and Dick and Peter? It's like meeting movie stars in a sense, in that you encounter someone for years through a certain medium, and then you see this person up close, and you say, "Oh, you're a real human being." You know, it's a real treat. I know you don't feel that way if they gave you a C on a test, but I'm talking about me right now. Okay, this is my time, and I'm telling you, it's wonderful to meet these people. But if I don't go back, how will I be able to walk down to the end of my driveway and get my copy of the Tallahassee Democrat every morning? Whence comes the following original work of Vers Libre? This is a poem that came from the newspaper, the local Florida newspaper that I was reading. So I ask you now to picture the professor of creative poetry sitting there in his smoking jacket with his ascot, and reading his Tallahassee Democrat and sitting bolt upright when he realizes that he has the subject of a poem. What I was reading at the time was a little article on the country of Paraguay that said that Paraguay was the most landlocked country in the world, which struck me as a metaphor for something. But what? Well, the only way to find out what, I thought, would be to go to the library and get out all the books on Paraguay, which I did. There were two of them. At the time I wrote the poem, there may be a third now, but at that time there were only two. And I began to read and take notes, much like someone writing an essay or a term paper. and found out some absolutely fascinating things about the country, which has an official language, Spanish, and an unofficial language, Guarani, the Indian language, which is the language that everyone uses. They use the unofficial more than the official. If you saw that movie, The Mission, with Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro, the Indians there were the Guarani Indians and speaking that language. I found out also that they have an unusual theology. There's a god named Tupang who is in everything. I mean, he's in everything. The Judeo-Christian god is sort of, he's in every building and he's in the air and he's all around us. But Tupang is in this microphone, in this poem. You know, it's in your shoe soles. He's literally, his spirit is infused everywhere. And as I began to read and take notes on this complicated and conflicted country, I realized that what I was working, by the way, the landlocked country business had long since disappeared. That was no longer of any interest or use to me. But I found out that I was putting together a love poem, and so the poem is called, I Think I'm Going to Call My Wife Paraguay. I think I'm going to call my wife Paraguay, for she is truly bilingual, even though she speaks no Guarani, and except for cucaracha and taco, hardly any Spanish at all. She has two zones, though, one a forest luxuriant with orchids and the smell of fruit trees, where the Indians worship the pure and formless Tupang, who shines in the lightning and roars in the thunder, and another zone, a dry place, a flat plain with the soul of a mountain, motionless and hard as a rock. During the day, the sun blazes on the red dust of Paraguay as dark-eyed, straight-backed women walk home from the river with bundles of laundry on their head, hoping to avoid trouble, for the Paraguayans are always fighting. Young conscripts lolling in faded cotton uniforms have no idea whether they will be summoned next to overthrow the government or defend it. My wife Paraguay and I ourselves had to fight the war of the Triple Alliance, although in our case it wasn't Brazil, Uruguay, and Argentina, but Harry, Edward, and Maurice, her former boyfriends. I won. War does not silence Paraguay or dismay her in any way, for still her people shout on the football fields and whisper declarations of love on the darkened patios of the old colonial houses, just as my wife Paraguay says that she loves me as the parakeet and toucan fly over and the perfume of the lime and orange tree blow through the windows of our big house, which I call South America because it contains Paraguay and is shaped like a sweet potato. I'm trying to do something in my family life by watching my children grow up and identify the precise moment when children stop having pure moods. If you can remember when you were about 8 or 9, someone would hand you an ice cream cone and you'd be transfixed with ecstasy. You'd look like that Bernini statue of Saint Teresa, you know, as she becomes Saint Teresa. Whereas if you take a child just a few years older and say, look, car keys, the child will sort of look at you like, what's the catch? You know, who's going to pay for the gas? You know, because they begin to become like us. Their moods begin to interpenetrate and become bittersweet and sweet and sour, and they get all mixed up. So I was looking for a metaphor for this mixture of moods, and I settled upon overcast skies because that's the best condition for driving when it looks as though it's going to rain, but it's not yet wet because there's no glare. You can drive without, you know, skidding off the road, but it's not bright either. So let me tell you about a couple of things in the poem. I like to give you sometimes a little rough chronometer of the three or four things that are going to show up. So as they do show up, you can check them off and you can feel yourself approaching the end of the poem with relief. There's a French phrase, le bonheur humain, which means human happiness. The foreign language is, I guess, a blessing for the poet and a curse for the readers, because sometimes something will look corny or stupid in English, and you always just throw it into another language if you know it, but then the poor reader's got to deal with that. So I thought I would explain that a little earlier. There's a story in here too, a little anecdote that someone told me recently I was in Hawaii in a deserted valley with some straight, very verdant cliff walls going up, and there was a scar. Well, there were two scars coming down, and I asked one of the few persons who lived in this valley where the scars came from, and he said, well, one fellow was driving a road grader, and he got a little bit too close to the edge, and the other one involves the story that I'm going to tell you, which involves a political conflict between some locals, some Hawaiian locals who were more politically conservative than the people that they had a conflict with. And then also there's a little quote from Darwin, a quote from The Origin of Species. And let me read that to you so you'll be ready for it when it comes. Darwin said, I am almost convinced, parenthesis, quite contrary to the opinion I started with, parenthesis, that species are not, parenthesis, it is like confessing a murder, parenthesis, immutable. So you see, he had this very simple, short sentence about the light bulb coming on, but in it he inserted all these guilty parenthetical expressions. The poem is called For Overcast Skies. It is when sunny too hot if dry, and when rainy too cool but slippery. Therefore, overcast skies constitute the best conditions pour le bonheur humain. But it takes one a while to realize these things. When I was young, I wasn't fit for much except going for pizza with the guys. But I was good at that. To paraphrase Voltaire, had I not existed, guys going for pizza would have had to invent me. Now I am wiser, happier, and also sadder, though just a little bit. Indeed, the wisdom may consist in realizing one can be happy and sad at the same time. I talked to a guy who used to be a hippie. He'd been camping in his van with other hirsute types on the big island of Hawaii when some locals, not eager to be bombed again by the Japanese and outraged at the van's peace symbols, pushed it into the Waipio Valley, while the hippies, tripping on this really great acid, thought, groovy, it looks like those dudes are destroying our van. He was sad he'd lost his means of transportation, but happy that he has a good story to tell. Besides, all this had taken place years ago. Same thing when Darwin discovered the principle of evolution. A cloud of shame came between him and his happiness. In the second draft of On the Origin of Species, 1844, he wrote, I am almost convinced, quite contrary to the opinion I started with, that species are not, it is like confessing a murder, immutable. You monkeys, uncle, you knew you were doing something wrong. You and your adorable parentheses. Okay, people always hate me when I say I was in Hawaii and this and that, but I have in-laws there, so you see there's a price to be exacted. I talked to a lot of different people in the Arizona cities I've been in. Part of this grant involved community service, which I thought meant picking up trash by the side of the road, you know, when they first offered it to me. But it turned out, no, that I would talk to some high school students and separate them from their angel dust and their switchblade knives and enlist them in the cause of poetry and, you know, just turn their lives right around. So the verdict isn't in on that yet, but I did my darndest. One kind of poem that I tried to teach them really quickly is a poem I call a marriage, which means simply that you get two things that don't have a thing in the world in common and you put them together and you make a poem out of that. Which also happens to be like some human marriages as well, but I'm only expert in the poetic kind, so this was the kind that I taught to these young punks and punkettes. And here's one. It's called The Cows Are Going to Paris, a pastoral. What happened was I was on a train in England, actually, and saw some cows lurching toward the train. It was one of those small English tracks with the fields, you know, virtually just inches away, and the cows came up to look, as cows will do, and I think some Some more curious cows in the back pushed and caused the others to lurch forward. And for a split second, I thought, oh, my God, the cows are going to get on the train and commit cow mayhem. And so I began to write this poem called The Cows Are Going to London. The Cows Are Going to London. And it kept being that one line. Somehow I got them across the channel. And it worked out better with them going to Paris. Chronometrical note here is that in the last stanza, I'll be referring to a celebrated painting by Watteau called The Voyage to Cythera, which shows some comely young men and women about to leave the Isle of Love. They have to go back to the real world. They have to leave the sort of earthly paradise that's depicted in the painting. And they look very sad about it. They're going to have to go back to the world of bills and backaches. And they're looking over their shoulders and they want to stay there. The cows are going to Paris. When they boarded the train at Corbeil and Fontainebleau, the people were frightened and ran out into the fields and meadows and chewed the grass in terror. And now the cows are going to shop at the Galerie Lafayette, stroll in the Louvre and the Jeu de Paume, see plays produced and directed by cows, a farce in the manner of Georges Feydeau, for example, in which a certain Monsieur Boule wishes to deceive his wife, so he arranges to meet the wife of a friend in a hotel of low repute. The only one who can betray him is another Monsieur who stutters whenever it rains. And of course it rains. Moo, he says. Moo. The cows are delighted. They have never thought of the rain as having so much meaning until now. And when the deceived monsieur grabs a sword in order to pierce the innards of his false friend, the cows are absolutely enthralled, it having never occurred to them that the slaughter of their species could be occasioned by anything other than the desire to eat or make money, that it could have rage at it as its cause, a feeling of betrayal, the breaking of a heart. Meanwhile, the people from the train have made themselves comfortable under the trees. The diet of the cows is nourishing and unrefined, and somehow it seems natural to stand in small groups for hours saying nothing. Indeed, when the cows return to the fields and meadows, the people will not get back on board and must be prodded before they enter the cars. Having been to the city, the cows understand. To them, the people are like the nymphs and shepherds in the painting by Watteau, who are made to leave the Isle of Forgetfulness and so set out for the fallen world, but slowly and not without a mournful backward glance. Another little tip I've been giving to the high schoolers is to simply retell stories that they've had in mind for years, the family stories or the stories that they dine out on or hog face out on or pig face out on or whatever it is that they do. And here's mine. This is the story that I've been telling for years, although like almost everything else in these poems, it's something that I stole from someone else. I guess I told that to the high school kids too. Don't let that stop you. This is a story that this will be the creepy part of tonight's presentation here. A couple of creepy poems coming up. This is a story that a man in Florence, Italy, told me. FSU has a foreign study program in Florence. And the director at that time had some people over, some faculty over for dinner, and began to tell this absolutely horrifying story as the light went down and the hills grew black and cold. And somehow their hills grow blacker and colder than our hills, or maybe it was the story itself. What happened was that this man had been married and had a child, and he and his wife were absolutely desperate to get away from the child. They just wanted an evening out. They were married graduate students in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they were suffering that the pain that all of you feel if you've ever been married and had a child and you don't know people with just squadrons of teenage girls that you can draw upon to use as babysitters, because the problem is if you're 25 and you have a 6-month-old child, the people who are old enough to have teenage girls are not going to be in your peer group, so they just couldn't find anybody. You'd think in a city that size they could, but they couldn't, and so finally they resorted to the Yellow Pages and found a church babysitting service. Sounds good, doesn't it? Well, hold on for a second. The poem is called Your Famous Story. The table has been cleared, and the guests are sitting around the fire with glasses of brandy and chartreuse as you begin to tell your famous story. How you and your wife were desperate to go somewhere, anywhere, after the birth of your first child, and finally found a service in the Yellow Pages, a church group that would send a babysitter, a gentlewoman, a grandmotherly type who came highly recommended, someone who had raised children of her own. You went to a movie and a coffee house, and when you got back, the sitter was just as you had left her, calm and smiling, assuring you that everything had been fine, that your little girl was an angel. And you laughed, saying that she must not have changed the baby's diapers, or she would have seen it was a boy. The sitter looked at the wall and said in a voice you had never heard before that while the baby might have been a boy when you left, he was certainly a girl now. You dashed upstairs and tore off the baby's pajamas, but of course he was fine. And that evening you told your story for the first time to the police, and then next morning the church group. They hid nothing, said the sitter had a history of threatening children with knives. But they were told all that was in the past, and now the good liberal church women were trying to rehabilitate her with lay counseling and the offer of regular work. There was a hearing, and you told your story again. The babysitter went behind walls. Your son grew up healthy and strong, and now he dines out on the story you are telling us now, the night coming down around your house like a hand that closes around the heart, opens a little, never lets go. I'm still in love with that idea, you know. Sure, you know, you had this criminal past. We'll fix it, you know. Honest. So use those Yellow Pages for the pizza services audience and not the babysitting services. Second creepy poem. It's called After Midnight, and I'm reading it because it gave... He gave Peter Wilde a long distance creeps. He wrote me and said he had the chicken skin, and so I figured I would try it and see if I can kind of unsettle him here. From the heart of this house come sounds, the soft bump of a receiver, the almost noiseless swish of the cord against the wall. Someone is hanging up the phone in the kitchen. Yet you are asleep, your nightgown bunched around your waist, and we are alone, or should be, and I am afraid, though not for us. I think it must be someone who is in great danger. I think it must be someone made crazy by pain. I think it must be someone who has been wandering from yard to yard and is now in our kitchen calling people in other cities, other countries, other worlds, saying, a child is missing, or everyone is dead in there, or I don't love you anymore. How about it, Peter? Still work? Okay, all right. That's all I ask. That's all I ask. Okay. Another poem I did for these, this was a group of high schoolers in Scottsdale, what I did was read them some poems and talk about some general principles. And you can't give high school kids the creeps, you know, so I didn't even bother with the creepy poems there. But I read them a couple of, more comic pieces. And then I asked for questions, which is always a big mistake. Because the first guy puts his hand up and he says, "What's it like to be a wretch and an outcast and to have people look down on you and think of you as a scumbum?" So I'm always so cool-headed in these matters, and I got defensive and angry and said, "Look, I've got an 85 Toyota Corolla, factory air, an AM radio. I'm okay. I have a house. I take my family on vacations." But then I realized that my questioner was right, that there is a kind of marginal status that poets ought to have and they ought to cling to it and hang on to it and keep getting themselves on the outside, keep positioning themselves on the outside and looking in. And I had this one poem, I think, that speaks to that issue, and so I pulled it out and read it to them. The poem is called "Still the Only Investment Guide You'll Ever Need," and it begins with the idea — this is sort of outside of the poem, but it leads into it — it begins with the idea that everybody loves a poet. You know, that whenever people find out there's a poet in their midst, you know, their hearts leap up and they're happy because I don't know why. Maybe they feel he is a wretch and an outcast and they feel superior. I think in my more weepy and romantic moments, though, I tell myself it's because they see the poet as being a kind of lineal descendant of Homer and Milton and all of these sort of shaggy ancestors there in our past. So everyone I've ever met has always been absolutely delighted to meet a poet, except this one person, who was somebody I was trying to buy a house from in Tallahassee, which is small. One's name, even one's photo, appears in the paper every once in a while, and so most people have been around Tallahassee for any period of time have a little bit of an idea who I am. So I think this guy was probably sizing me up and figuring, well, he's a poet, he can't be too bright. I'll work him over. So we began to negotiate, and I actually think that I was getting the better of this fellow, you see, which of course brought out the worst in him. "The only time I was ever scorned for being a poet was when I was trying to buy a house, and negotiations fell through, and the seller got angry. And he said, 'You're a poet, aren't you?' And I admitted I was, knowing something terrible was coming next, yet unable to deny my passion, my livelihood, my identity, no less. Though what he said was no worse than that I should go back to my poems and leave the cold, hard world of business to men like himself, real men, practical types who understand how things work. You think poets don't understand how things work? Mister, I know you backward and forward, that's for sure. You're the kind of guy who thinks his wife is ugly and his kids are dumb, and who sits next to me on the airplane and says, 'Is there any money in that?' after I confess my secret. See, I never wanted you to know I was a poet in the first place, even though I'm proud of what I do. I work hard, take chances. Hell, I'm up all night sometimes. What's more, I'm an American poet. Got a lot of dark humor in these poems, a lot of narrative, and more colloquialisms than you could shake a stick at. I do what Whitman did, Emily Dickinson, William Carlos Williams, and you belittle me? You traitor, you communist. Shame on you for hating your country so much. Look, I'm not angry. I feel sorry for you. Frankly, you've wasted your life. You used to write poetry. Why did you stop? A deal is a deal. It just leads to other deals. But a poem is a summary of everything that the poet feels and knows up to that point in his or her life. A poem, therefore, is the greatest economy, a bargain. It's like two for the price of one, only better. See what I mean? You're not a real man after all. Let's face it. You don't know how to handle your money." The high school students always like that because they see their parents in there often, somewhere. I'd like to say something about the male sex, which is that when they do not have their clothes on, audience, they are ugly. This is I came to this astonishing conclusion after signing up at a health club and getting a chance to hang around with a lot of naked men and study them. The title of this poem is one that students of musical history will recognize as a James Brown song title. The title of the other one, Still the Only Investment Guide You'll Ever Need, is the title of a book by Andrew Tobias. If you don't know already, titles can't be copyright, which is why my next book of poetry is, it's either going to be called The Bible or The Dictionary. I'm not quite sure. But one of those, or maybe the Biblical Dictionary or something like that. But this poem is called Money Won't Change You, But Time Will Take You Out. It doesn't take very many visits to the men's locker at the pool where I go for my daily swim to realize why it is that men chase women. First, there is the baggy skin, alternately too white or too red. Then the hair, thin or gray, or worst of all, a near transparent, almost colorless color like oatmeal. And the overall effect of being grizzled, like once shaggy beasts gone balding and slack in the gut. The men look like big possums, patchily haired and irritable, or livestock whose hides have been scraped and boiled on the way to a final cure. Then you have your wins, your buboes, your bosses, your separating pustules. And the penises, great warty ropes, or stupid one-eyed slugs asleep beneath the ponderous overhang of belly. I am thinking of asking permission to change on the women's side. With the express understanding, of course, that I would be as businesslike there as I am across the hall with members of my own sex. But what if the women turned out to be as unwholesome in their appearance as the men? What if they were themselves a bunch of buffaloes? Today in the newspaper, a woman described herself in the personals section as, quote, smart, silly, and good-looking, end quote. But time gives us such a blackguarding as would scour the hide of an alligator, and the newspapers themselves make us stupid. Silliness is all that is left to us. Silly means foolish or unreasoning these days, but in Middle English it meant blessed. Look it up. A little while back, I came across a wonderful anecdote about a meeting of the conductor Toscanini and the composer Strauss, an anecdote that I checked out through several different biographies and found out there were wildly varying accounts of it, but I picked the one that worked into the poem best. It has to do with Toscanini's use of his trademark Homburg hat. Toscanini apparently was a right-minded fellow. Strauss had something of a reputation as a Nazi sympathizer, and Toscanini did not like Strauss and was rude to him in a very effective way that you will hear about shortly. But really, this poem starts with a more common feeling, one that I'm sure each and every one of you has felt in the last week. It's a feeling that comes with sitting around a table under a single bare light bulb and thinking, I've got to do something noble. I've got to learn how to teach people to read, or I've got to volunteer at the health clinic or help the homeless or do something like that. Wanting to do something better, that's how the poem begins. It's called Soft Black Hat. I feel like doing something especially high-minded tonight. Only the little ones Only the little things are the ones that are often the most attractive. For instance, you can pull the head off a mechanical chicken and mount your friend's picture on the mechanism and wind it up and watch your friend bounce around on the kitchen table until he falls off. And you wouldn't even have to dress up. As Thoreau says, beware of any enterprise that calls for new clothes. Clothes are nice, though, and sometimes you can use them to make a point. As when Toscanini met Richard Strauss, composer of Der Rosenkavalier, but also a Nazi sympathizer, and said, I take my hat off to you as a musician, R. Strauss, here removing his trademark Homburg, but as a man, I put it on again 10 times, which he did, on, off, until he had finished. That settled R. Strauss's swastika-loving ass for sure. But villains are hard to come by, especially in a big country like America. Signor Toscanini was lucky, since Herr Strauss sought him out in his dressing room at La Scala, and not vice versa. With you, it might be different. But scoundrels seldom come to me for my disapproval. So maybe each of us should work on his or her specialty, conducting, whatever, and become the kind of person others flock to, hero and villain alike, though the latter would not always look villainous. Indeed, they'd try to be as presentable as possible. Therefore, it is our duty to be better looking than they are. We'll be like Toscanini, artists, humanitarians, snappy dressers. Being as close as I'll ever be, possibly, to Las Vegas, I'd like to read a poem called Dracula in Las Vegas, which features the caped count as a hero, and puts him up against Elvis, who is a monster in the poem, and I suppose was a kind of nocturnal monster at the end of his life, you know, bloating and growing fatter and eating too much and doing all the things that we heart healthy types know that we shouldn't do. So there's a part that is a little difficult to follow, in which Elvis undergoes a transformation, I'll try to lead you through that with a little bit of dispatch. Just hang on, because that part will, when you get to the part where you get confused and lost, hang on, because it'll be over very, very shortly. What happens is that there's a kind of epic struggle, and Las Vegas is redeemed. I'm sure they're very interested in being redeemed by David Kirby, but that's what happens, at least in the poem. As Dracula is killing the pimps of Las Vegas, begging them not to sell their sisters into bondage, and then flying into a rage and tearing their throats out when they laugh at him and call him a jive chump, Elvis is crawling out of the penthouse window at the Hilton International. Tonight he is going to make his stand before the over 30 crowd. Pacing back and forth like a cat-footed killer, he's going to give them all he's got, and then wipe the sweat from his face with scarves and fling them into the audience. But right now he's crawling down the side of the Hilton head first, wrapped in a red monk's robe over black nylon pajamas and patent leather boots, his eyes screened by tinted aviator glasses with the initials EP across the bridge. He reaches the sidewalk and lands lightly on his feet just as Dracula steps forward and raises a hand as if to say, stop. Ah, cries Elvis, like a mountain lion with an arrow in his ribs, as behind him appear the dead of the desert, the naked Paiute Indians who bet their wives on the toss of a stick, the horse soldiers in blue, their skin hanging from their faces, the Mormons who slaughtered gentle immigrants from Arkansas on the strength of a revelation. Dracula shakes his head. I see you are afraid to face me alone, he says. I've got to have my power, Elvis snarls. I've got to have my dynamics. You lounge lizard, says the sanguinary count. Whatever happened to my Transylvania twist? Elvis screams and writhes like a man in flames. The monk's robe changes color, becomes light blue and vaporous, like the screens of millions of television sets on Sunday night when America sat down in a body to watch Ed Sullivan wring his hands and bring out Elvis in his prime, along with Leslie Gore, the Doodletown Pipers, Gary Lewis and the Playboys, and Mary Hopkins singing "Those Were the Days." And the robe becomes bluer still as it gathers at the legs and waist, settling over the shoulders like a jacket from which someone has forgotten to remove the hanger, the lapels as lumpy as cold gravy, the suit as blue now as the jowls of former U.S. President Richard M. Nixon, whose head floats where Elvis's did, the eyes wide, the lips silently mouthing the words, "I am not a crook," and then freezing in an inaudible scream as the dead of the desert burst into laughter and melt dervish-like into the first rays of the sun. Something stirs at Dracula's foot, a green shoot, then another and another. A carpet of grass rolls across the desert, a tide of vegetation broken here and there by shade trees and pools where the Corrines and the croupiers bathe, the call girls, the mobsters come down from their meat hooks, all children again, children in the slowly warming air. Okay, I've just got two more for you here to wake you up and get you out. I have a poem about coffee. This poem appeared in a little magazine, Fine magazine called Fine Madness, which is published in Seattle. And it's a poem I think you all ought to be sending your poems to as well. It's one of those poems. It was the kind of poem you sneak in. It's the second best poem in a manuscript. You know, you put the first best poem in so that the editor will, of course, just, you know, grab it and call the printing factory and say, "Stop the presses." And then you put the second best one in so that the editor will see how fine the first one is. And of course, that never works. The editor, in his misguided way, never takes the best poem, but always the second best. And so I didn't, you know, I was happy. I didn't mind that it appeared at all, but didn't feel anything special about it. But here's where the harmonic convergence comes in. The day that I was to leave for Arizona, that is to say, a week ago, last Wednesday, October the 4th, I got a letter from Naomi Nye, whom I understand is to appear here in just a couple of weeks. And the effect of her letter was to say, "I really like this poem about coffee in Fine Madness," which I took as a kind of omen, not about the poem's success, but about the net of poetry that we all bounce around in, and also about the possibility for connection, because if she could connect with me, then it made me think that I could connect with you, or if I couldn't connect with you, it would not be for any lack of trying on my part. So here's one more shot at it, and the poem is called Bottomless Cup. The best thing in the world is coffee, especially the cup I have with my wife every day. Three scoops of espresso and one of American coffee with chicory filtered. Around town, it's commercially prepared and lousy. But I drink it anyway in honor of that first cup, which makes the subsequent ones not so bad, and because I love the stuff. Of course, various hosts and hostesses in this city make very serviceable coffee after the dinners to which I am often invited, having something of a reputation as a useful hand in the kitchen and more than passable conversationalist. But by then it's too late in the evening for good coffee, which only disturbs sleep, thus dulling one's appreciation of that matutinal cup, the first one, every day. It's silly to get caught up in rituals, I know, but a friend told me his father recovered from his mother's death by taking up again the little routines he'd practiced daily all his life. So coffee might save me from despair one of these days, since I certainly don't expect to go through without my share of blows. Well, you see, that ruins it. Now all this coffee drinking has a purpose, which it shouldn't. I don't even need the stuff to wake up with, being fairly jumpy most of the time anyway. I suppose I drink it because I want to be more like coffee myself, the thing people need when they get up in the morning and then all day long, something even the poor can afford. I want to find myself everywhere. I want to be the thing that's bad for you if you get too much. Thank you very much. I very much appreciate your attendance and your attention. This is the last poem. I always, no matter how much community service I'm doing and no matter how much trash I've picked up by the side of the road, I always try to calm students down, my students, your students, anybody's students, by telling them to start small. You know, poetry's hard enough to write without you tackling the cosmos or truth or beauty. You know, start small and let the effort come in later when you're refining your small concept. And this last poem is an illustration of that. It was stimulated by the visit of a friend of my wife who was talking to my wife as I was preparing supper. And in the other room, I heard this friend say, "What's it like being married to Dave?" And the title of the poem is "The Meaning of Women's Laughter." Through the kitchen's thin walls, I hear my wife's girlfriend in from California ask, "What's it like being married to Dave?" My wife says something I cannot hear, and then there is a chuckle. Two. A torrent of helpless laughter. I think of Miss Parham, my third grade teacher, who used to say, "We're not laughing at you, honey. We're laughing with you." Whenever a child came close to tears, only once, when Putsy Trice came back from the bathroom with toilet paper hanging out of her pants, Miss Parham mixed up her prepositions and told Putsy we were laughing at her. And it was true. Only Putsy Trice was a show-off and didn't care. I care. Standing in my kitchen, I care whether or not my wife thinks to love someone no matter how badly they treat you. And then I hear the voices of the two women begging me to come in and dance with them. We do the hitchhike. We do the swim. The song stops and another starts. It says, "Sometimes I clown, back up and do the James Brown." My wife slips into my arms and we dip, glide, tango. The friend from California has left the room. We kiss long and slow and keep dancing. Thanks very much.